Alright. Groovy.
There we go.
Okay. Alright, I guess.
I guess I'm moderator this time. Does anybody have a preference if we start with the probability or the sampling articles? Okay, if not.
Yes.
That would be
it
you.
Okay. I guess
what were you going to say, Harold?
I was going to say, it seemed like there was more written for the sampling inference stuff, but I think some other stuff popped up on the probability page now, too.
Yes, that's my...
I checked.
Yeah, last time I checked, the probability one was 6 pages and the sampling one was 5 pages. I think, are you doing you're doing a sampling one, right, Harla?
Yes, I was going to talk a little bit more about one of the sampling ones.
And I'm doing sampling. And Lee, you were doing probability?
Yeah, I was going to do a probability one.
And Jackie, you were doing probability?
Yes.
Holly Lynn, were you doing one?
I couldn't actually remember what our role was, if Randy and I were each supposed to discuss one. I did post one, and I'm happy to discuss it, and it is under the probability, but I couldn't remember whether we were supposed to be...
I don't think we made it clear as to whether...
This is Felicity, and I'm here at last, and I had the same issue, but I also did some probability stuff just because I thought it was really interesting.
Okay. And Randy, were you planning...
No, I read the notes. I got to read the notes from the end of the last call. I wasn't in on that part of it. I wasn't planning to.
So we have 6 of us who have. So should we try to go about 10 minutes for each of us at the most? Try to limit us to just over an hour. Is that okay with you guys, or is that too limiting?
I think it actually it might be too much. If
too much.
That's what I was thinking.
Well, I was including discussion in that.
Yeah.
So I was including summary in any discussion. But, okay, we can go shorter. What were your articles? Holly Lynn, you were probability too, right?
Yes, I was.
And Felicity was probability?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we might as well do the 2 sampling ones and get them out of the way. And then we can do the rest of the time on the probability.
Good.
I can start with mine. Mine was another Thompson article. It was conceptions of sample and their relationship to statistical inference. And he started by discussing the singular versus the distributional perspective when you're talking about sampling. And he argued that you need to have a distributional perspective in order to be able to do inferencing. He said that when students take a singular perspective, they have difficulty thinking of an outcome in terms of how unusual it is, and they have difficulty learning about inferencing because they can't make that connection. The study was designed to look at how the students' thinking develops as they move towards a distributional perspective and whether how engaged they are in the instruction would impact the development. I thought it was interesting. He did a teaching experiment, but he also talked about the fact that they called an epistemological analysis. And I looked up another paper of his where he talked about epistemological analysis. And basically they're saying, in the quotes he has, what does it mean to understand X and how might people develop such an understanding? And he talked about different kinds of psychological theories and stuff that were coming in. This particular experiment that he did was with 11th and 12th grade students, but it wasn't an AP stats course. And they collected data through participation in the classroom. They videotaped everything again, discussions and written work. And they actually started each with news reports, and then they did simulations to see how unusual the results were. He found that when they used a multi-level process to generate sampling distributions, the students understood that the process generated a collection, but there were also those students who confused the number of samples with the number of people, and most students fell into the latter category. They looked at it as a total number of people. And he calls that an additive view, and he says that when we simplify as a subset of the population, that's when the students get an additive view. And then he spent some time talking about multiplicative conception of sampling, which they need to develop a distributional view. And he viewed these two things as extreme. The multiplicative view helps students understand why statisticians have confidence in the results when drawing a single sample. And few students were able to develop that. But it looks like this Saldana, is that how you say his name? Do you guys know him?
I do know him, but I don't know how to pronounce his name.
It looks like that was actually his dissertation. Because when I did some searching on the multiplicative conception of sample, I came up with a 300-page dissertation by him.
Yeah, so the teaching experiment was actually from an NSF grant that Thompson had.
Yes.
And Lewis and Yan Liu, I think Herla may have added a paper by...
Actually, that might be mine.
Oh, it was yours? Okay, somebody added a paper that I saw listed in there from Yan and Pat Thompson, and Yan also did her dissertation around that teaching experiment, but looking more at the follow-up of, there was a two-part, working with students and working with teachers, and her dissertation looked around the teachers. But didn't we read one of Lewis's articles back in, like, August or July?
We did. Yes, we did.
And I think the data was from that same study.
It was, because when I was reading through, the descriptions that they were using were not similar to what we had read in the past. Like when they were talking about what they did with each student and they were giving dialogue and stuff, it didn't seem to coincide with the experiments that we had read about. But do you think it's the same one?
Yeah, I'm trying to go back to our minutes to remember which paper we read. I can't remember. It may have been maybe just another piece of that entire study, but not what was presented in the article that you just summarized.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the other article we read was Exploring Connections Between Sampling Distributions and Statistical Inference, an analysis of students' engagement and thinking in the context of instruction involving repeated sampling. That was the other one. And it is it was published a little bit later than this Conceptions of Sample article here.
This one ends by saying that they were doing a different study, and the, hold on. It says in a subsequent teaching experiment, they engaged students in instructional activities designed to foreground ideas of sampling variability and support their developing multiplicative conception of sample. So maybe the subsequent teaching experiments, the one that we read about.
Right, right. Very well could have been.
Oh, mine was not with, it was with the teachers, not with the students.
Right.
So, oh, okay. So I'm not
right,
sure.
I think she was referring to the prior article by Solana and Thompson that we read August. Yeah.
Okay.
That perhaps that was their follow-up teaching experiment.
Ah.
But I don't remember that phrase, the multiplicative conception of sample. I don't remember seeing that before. Have we seen that particular phrase before? Because I don't remember seeing that. Because
right.
I had to look up he referred to the multiplicative reasoning from a mathematical perspective.
Yeah.
And I had to look up some information about it, and I don't remember doing that before. But everything's so hectic, we could have. So.
Right. Well, we may not have necessarily attached that. But I mean, but let's think about this. So what do you think a multiplicative, based on what you read?
Well, I think he's right. I think most of our students do go to the additive view. I don't think they understand when we take the multiple samples, when we do our sampling distribution, I think they have difficulty with it. And I think most of our students don't have the multiplicative. But I don't know. He says that you need to design your lessons and stuff to develop that. But I guess I imagine doing a lot of simulation and stuff would help.
Mm-hmm.
No? Do you guys do a lot of simulation?
I don't really.
Do you think that they understand when we do the sampling distribution? Do you think they view?
You can go ahead.
I was going to say, I've started to do a little bit more as I've started to see more of it in some of the workshops and things I've gone to.
Uh-huh.
And I think it is making things a little bit clearer for students. That was all I was going to.
Yeah. I think, though, you still have to be careful in terms of how you present the information. Because I've done a couple examples with them this term where I'll have them do, like, whatever it is we're going to be simulating, I'll have them run through the process by hand in groups first. So if
uh-huh.
it's, you know, counting the proportion of orange Reese's Pieces candies, I give them some candy and they go through and they count it and they each plot their proportions and we look. And then I do like an applet to follow up on that where we can simulate it a lot of times. But I'm not sure I really in that emphasized well enough the difference. I would talk about how the shape would change as sample size changed, but I don't think I really emphasized well enough the difference between sample size and number of samples. And looking back on it, I think there is still a little bit of lingering confusion. Especially since, you know, the idea of having them do it first seems like a nice idea, but then when they plot their results, I have 18 groups, so it looks absolutely nothing like a distribution because the number of samples are too small for you to see the picture take place.
Right.
And so I think then they don't really understand that the number of samples is not an inherent part of the theory of sampling distribution. It's just kind of you need a lot in order to see the results versus how sample size plays a much more intrinsic role. Like I'm not really sure they're grasping that fine line. So I think the simulation is probably better than some of the other things we've been doing in the past, but I'm not sure. Like I think it needs to still be very clearly explained within the context of the simulation.
Yeah, I do the exact same thing. I do the Reese's Pieces, and I have a really small statistics class, and I have each student number, we find the proportion, we plot it up, and we talk about it, and then I do the same thing, I use an applet, and we vary sample size and stuff. But, yeah, I think that even if they get that, when then I take that and we go to talk about means, sampling distribution for means, they don't understand that, they don't make a connection.
Just as a kind of a side note, because I did kind of discover this, has anybody found that even just the idea of doing a simulation, just that idea of how this models what we're trying to model, sort of escapes students a little bit? Because
lots of people talk about that. In research, this is Holly Lynn, I think in research literature, lots of people talk about that and how you... that depending on the purpose of what you're using the simulation for, having them be part of the modeling perspective, the modeling part of getting the simulation to do what it needs to do is a good thing. And making sure that there's some explicit connections made between the real-world phenomena that you're trying to simulate and how you're mapping that into running the simulation. And I think you can start doing that with, without the computer. So you have a context and you want to simulate. And so a very simple one is thinking about, you want to simulate births. Well, you don't want to, you know, line people up and have, you know, examine the babies that they have. And so you try to come up with a situation to model that. Well, I could do a bag of marbles that has, you know, so first of all, I have to make some assumptions. And so you kind of walk them through, well, the assumptions that I'm making about here is that, you know, I can, it's probably pretty safe, although not exactly safe, to assume a 50-50 distribution. You know, if you look at the data, it's more like 51 something for boys. But if you just, you know, for simplicity, you do that, then you could talk about, well, I could do a spinner that is 50% this and 50% this, or I could do a coin toss, or I can do, and then talking about, well, then if I invoke one spin of the spinner, what does that represent? Well, that represents having a baby, you know.
Yeah.
And so whether you're doing it with physical objects or a computer, I think you're absolutely right that if you just all of a sudden start gathering data from some simulation, there's real danger that you've lost them because they don't know exactly what the model represents.
Yeah, I was just a bit surprised, I think, because, you know, I guess maybe because it's something, it was just clear to me, you know, in that example, you know, giving birth, you have a coin, you just flip 50-50 for boys and girls, you know, if you just do something, that connection seemed difficult for some of them. And,
right.
And
right.
It was a little bit of a surprise as I was starting to.
Well, and
I
think it's different when, so I try to think about the difference between an experiment and a simulation. So a probability experiment and a probability simulation. Where a probability experiment, whatever tools I'm using, and however I'm gathering the data, I'm gathering the data in a way that's true to the context as far as it's the exact thing that happens in the context. So if it's about, if it's about births, then I'm actually collecting birth data.
Okay.
You know? But if it's about births and I'm collecting coin tosses, I'm doing a simulation of births.
Okay. Mm. That's interesting. Sorry, didn't mean to get us off track.
No, but I think that, I mean, if you continue having discussions about simulations and, you know, whether or not they, you know, whether or not or how they might be used to, you know, promote ideas of inference, I think it's an important conversation to have.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to try and think about, like, those issues of not just, like Colleen was saying, not just starting the simulation, but how do you frame the simulation, how do you implement the simulation, and, like, what are the important things you need to talk about and point out to them, rather than just saying, oh, you know, go use these applets, which I think, you know, as educators, we get kind of excited about these new ideas, and like you were saying, Lee, sometimes it can be a surprise that it doesn't translate to our students as well as it as we kind of pictured it in our head. So I think having, like, starting to look more systematically at where are the parts in the applet where they struggle, where, you know, mm-hmm. and then what can we do, how can we present that information to help them, I think will take something that has a lot of promise as a useful tool to aid understanding and actually make it much even more useful.
Can I ask the methodology that he uses, the epistemological analysis, is that always with a teaching experiment? Do you know? Have you?
My understanding of an epistemological analysis is that you don't even need research subjects to do it, that you're basically taking doing a psychological analysis of what would it mean for somebody to deeply understand this concept.
See, that's not how he described it. He said, what does it mean to understand it, and how do people develop the understanding? So, like, what processes do they follow? How do they get from point A to point B?
Uh-huh.
That's the way he described it.
Well, then I think that sounds like something that you would end up with, I mean, as far as kind of developing having a framework on how someone might understand something, how that emerges from an analysis of data.
Yeah, and that's kind of what that's kind of what he did with the article that I was looking at. It was the same kind of grounded theory where they basically had no idea what they were going to come out of this with when they went in and looked at the data, and they sort of let the data generate their models of how, well, in this case, it was how teachers understood probability.
So his was a yours was a teaching experiment also?
Yes, yeah. But it was with teachers over in a summer session.
Right. I just, because we talked last time how we can't do a teaching experiment because we don't have all the resources that we would need. And it seems like most of what we're reading, that's the methodology that they're using.
But, you know, some of what you're talking about, you could really add to the literature by getting a more in-depth understanding of where the disconnect is, which could really be more of a small qualitative discussion with a small group of people rather than something that's bigger and set within a course.
Yeah, the article that I looked at, they actually interviewed eight teachers. And, I mean, even though you're talking small, actually this article is very long. And, I mean, the volume of data that they had, it was actually a lot to parse through.
Exactly. I mean, something like that, it takes a lot of work to do something like that. It's okay, from my point of view as a statistician, it's much easier to go through and just have people do a bunch of surveys or something like that, but you really learn more by talking to people and getting that qualitative assessment.
Yeah.
Wait, do you want to summarize yours now since it kind of goes with?
Sure, I can. So basically, they had a summer seminar workshop that they put together, the purpose being that they were going to get some teachers together. They wanted to model teachers' understanding of probability through guided discussions. So it was professional development, but it was also for research purposes. So 4 days a week, they had activities and guided discussions for the teachers, and then on Fridays, they interviewed the teachers over 8 weeks during the summer. The particular paper I'm looking at covered the first 2 weeks that they collected. They had eight teachers that they asked into this particular seminar. And one of the things I found funny is they said that they hadn't had extensive coursework in statistics, but then they actually showed their background. And I thought for high school teachers, they actually had extensive coursework in statistics, given some of the students that we have here. One had had two courses in math stat, another one had had regression analysis, another one had, you know, they at least had one or two courses in statistics, and some of them in mathematical statistics, which I don't know, some of the other people might weigh in on, you know, what high school math teachers, I don't know, they don't necessarily have that much statistics, I thought. But anyway, I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing. So the data they collected, they videotaped all of the sessions during the week. Then they also videotaped the interviews. They interviewed all the teachers three times. They also kept all of the written work. They kept all of their field notes. And one of the interesting things that they did when they were looking at this, it was to understand their conceptions of probability, but it was also with sort of a look down the road to how do they also understand inference. But they discussed inference in the first week and then discussed probability in the second week. And obviously in the first week when they discussed inference, it was sort of in an informal way, just looking at sampling distributions. They had a schedule of topics in here, sorry. So the first week they talked about data, sampling, polls, statistical unusualness, margin of error, students' understanding of distribution of sample statistics. So that's what they're talking about, inference in the first week. And then the second week they talked about textbook analysis of probability introduction, probabilistic versus non-probabilistic situations, conditional probability, more conditional probability, measures of association. So that's what they did in the second week. Okay, so basically they had a ton of data. And there's kind of a lot to summarize, so I'll just kind of hit on a couple of things that I just thought were really interesting. Instead of trying to sort of summarize down into a couple of sentences what they found. One of the things that I thought was very interesting, they did, it was a very much, I said before, it was kind of grounded theory. They had no, or they tried not to have any preconceptions of what kind of thinking the teachers were going to have before they went in and analyzed the data. They tried to let the data, the models come out of the data entirely. So they analyzed these videos. They went through like three or four times through these videos as a group picking out things that they thought were interesting and categorizing and coding and doing all of that. Couple of things that they found. On the first day, several of the teachers had some pretty good understanding of probability and sort of a stochastic reasoning. They talked about, they asked them, what does it mean when you have a 45% chance of rain? What does that mean? And a couple of them actually said something along the lines, well, if you have 100 similar days, then 45 of those days, it'll rain. And so they kind of came in with a pretty good understanding of what it means to have, you know, sort of long-term probability, relative frequency kind of idea. But then they asked them a question along the lines of, if you sample 30 people and ask them if they prefer Coke or Pepsi, what's the likelihood that 18 of 30 of them will prefer Coke? And when they got to that question, that actually got less or non-stochastic responses, because basically people were answering, or the teachers were answering sort of based on their own preferences. Like, one of the teachers preferred Coke, and she's like, well, I don't understand why anyone would prefer Pepsi. And so it was, they were sort of, you know, they were bringing in their own personal preferences and not really using probability reasoning. So I thought that was interesting. They also mentioned that they discovered that when you use the word likelihood, when we were talking about language, that the teachers seemed to think that that did not call for a quantitative interpretation when they were talking about the Coke and Pepsi example. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, they did an example with cards and clowns. And basically, let me find the example here. The point of the example is they've got a clown sitting with three cards in front of them. They show you that the first card is red on both sides, the second is white on both sides, the third one is red on one side and white on the other. The clown picks them up, shuffles them, hides them in a hat, draws out one card at random, lays them on the table in a manner that you can only see one side of the card. And the clown says, this card is red on the side that we see, so it's either red, the red-red card, or it's the red-white card. I'll bet you $1 that the other side is red. So the questions they asked him is, what is the probability that you would win this bet were you to take it? Discuss how you're thinking about this situation in order to formulate an answer. You know, and we'll watch some video experts of students attempting to make sense of the situation, because, again, they're dealing with teachers, and so watching students. Kind of to shorten this up a little bit, basically they had sort of two different camps, or three different camps actually develop in terms of what their response or what their answer was. Some said one-half, some said one-third, and another group said, well, it's either one or zero. And the point of the question was there was no correct answer. It was more about discussing exactly what the, how did they put it? There's assumptions that you have to make in order to answer the question, and if you have different assumptions, then you have a different, you come to a different conclusion. And so the teachers kind of got into a really detailed, like, two-hour discussion about this problem, and when they interviewed the teachers about it later, they said it made them really uncomfortable, and they really didn't like the fact that there wasn't a correct answer. And by the end of the week, they were a little more comfortable with the fact that there wasn't a correct answer, but they said that they wouldn't do that in their class, that they would avoid that question in their own class because they just weren't comfortable with that idea. And so I thought that was another really interesting sort of conclusion from this. And then the last little thing I'll just say, I'm sorry, I know I'm going on a little bit. They said that concepts of probability were not, one of the conclusions they came to was that their concepts of probability were not grounded in the concept of distribution and thus did not support thinking about statistical inference. They said everything was very compartmentalized with the teachers. And as we're talking about, you know, how probability relates to inference, they said that instruction really needs to be geared toward crossing those compartments. So I'll just sort of leave it at that. Sorry, sort of talked a lot.
So. I think that's actually interesting. It kind of relates to one of the articles I read where they were having people classify events as either random or not. And they used a mix of events that are purely more stochastic, so stuff like drawing marbles from a bag. And then they also talked about real items, so things like the probably, you know, winning the lottery. And they said that for the most part, people were comfortable with the stochastic items saying that they were random. But with the real items, they defaulted then to thinking about whether or not a causal explanation could exist. And in most cases, they would try and identify a causal factor, and then they'd say, well, that can't be random because it's actually causal. And I think it's interesting that I've seen this theme in a few other places, too, that people just really, really struggle with this idea of randomness and stochastic events. It seems like as a species, somehow, we're much more comfortable with deterministic thinking. And that seems to lead to all these problems with understanding probability and then the implications that has for understanding distribution and then going into inference. It really all seems to kind of come back to this idea of, for some reason, we want things to be deterministic. You know, I noticed this theme starting to come up in a lot of research on probability and on randomness, that people have a hard time with that, especially when you put context in it. If you can isolate context, people are kind of, you know, make it seem somewhat artificial. People are kind of okay saying, all right, that would be random. But once you put context into it, we want everything to be deterministic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the Coke-Pepsi thing. She wanted to put her own preferences into it, and then they ran into that. And, yeah, that was one of sort of the categories that came out of they kind of broke it down a little bit more. One of the categories that came out of this article is how they were classifying the probability thinking. But I think they called it the outcome approach, which I think goes back to there's a Conold. I think Conold actually back to the 80s or early 90s sort of defined that. But that basically that idea that, you know, you use kind of your own personal experiences to determine or to assign probabilities to things instead of using.
Although I'm not sure that's what the outcome approach is.
Oh, maybe I'm getting that wrong. Sorry.
But I mean, I still agree that I think we use our personal preferences a lot, and they definitely major. I mean, so there's things like, I mean, even just going back to Kahneman and Tversky, the availability heuristics.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of, the availability.
You know, I mean, if you're able to think about that something occurred, you attach more likelihood to it. You know, if you know somebody who was struck by lightning, well, all of a sudden, then if that becomes
more
conceived, you know, perceived as more likely to you.
Yeah, that connects to another article I read about. I think that one I thought of in the concept of sampling. It was an article by Jennifer Kaplan where she looked at this belief bias, where she basically said when it's something you can believe, you don't associate randomness or probability with it, or you don't. She was, I think, looking at bias, but I think what you're describing is kind of a parallel here.
Mm-hmm.
If it's something you believe in, you're willing to accept it, or you might be willing,
if you don't believe it, if you don't believe it to begin with, then you know, you might question it, or you might want to search for more data. You might be
you're going to look for some alternative explanation or something. Like, you're not just going to.
Oh, just engage in any kind of political conversation with somebody who makes some type of, you know, well, I heard, you know, blah 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 blah. You know, or they reported, you know, something, and people automatically don't believe it or don't believe it based on whether they're a Democrat or Republican.
Yeah. I wonder, going back to this idea of how uncomfortable people are with things in particular contexts being random. Does anyone know of any research as to why that happens? Like, I see this being a theme in the probability research that this does happen. But does anyone know why we're so resistant to the idea of stochastic arguments in a context we're familiar with or something like that?
I think, this is Felicity, I think humans are actually hardwired to learn very quickly based on experience. I don't know what literature is set to look into for that, but we're really wired to look for patterns very quickly, and because of that I think we're resistant to the idea of things being random.
I wonder then if to some extent with probability we're fighting a losing battle, because it would seem to me like we almost need to teach people to think stochastically. But if we're hardwired to think deterministically, I'm not sure that's worth, you know, putting time and money into developing curricular materials to go completely against, you know, human biology or chemistry or whatever it is. One of the articles I was reading, Lee, I think it was actually the article you read too about by Alan Rossman, the recent one, One Statistician's View. He talked a lot about the Bayesian perspective and how some of these problems can be corrected or kind of alleviated when you look at things from the Bayesian perspective as opposed to the frequentist. So I wonder if that is something that the statistical field really needs to take a hard look at. If we're coming up with all this evidence of, listen, human beings just fundamentally have a hard time grasping the idea of probability in the frequentist sense, if we need to look at, you know, what's going to happen to inference if we do it from a Bayesian perspective. And it seems like, you know, people are starting to engage in this Bayesian versus frequentist debate even at the intro level, and if that's something that, you know, warrants a little more in-depth discussion.
Well, just quickly before you, you know, this slightly goes backwards to the previous comment about, you know, probability being really difficult. And one of the things that I posted in the Google groups was the last couple sentences of the Canold-Kazak article that I was suggesting. And they're talking about the difficulty of probabilistic thinking and how slow it may be to actually become a probabilistic thinker, and that it may not happen in, you know, the designing week-long units or, you know, couple months units. You know, all of a sudden you don't emerge from that as a stable,
yeah,
you know, probabilistic thinker, and that it really does, that it really may be that it is, you know, developed slowly over time, which, you know, poses a problem when you're now in an intro stats class and you have students with various different backgrounds that you have absolutely no control over, and, you know, you've got 15 weeks and maybe, if you're lucky, 3 of those weeks to teach them something about, you know, inference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something, like, in the intro stat course I'm teaching right now, we got rid of the formal unit on probability and the formal unit on random variables. But now that we're getting into inference, they're still struggling with the idea of a p-value, you know, and I never, like, formally defined a p-value. So now I need to be careful about how I talk about a p-value. I did formally define a p-value before everyone guessed. I never formally defined a conditional probability. So now I have to be careful about how I talk about a p-value because they don't have that formal background. Like, I don't want to just introduce that term in the middle of a unit where there's already a lot of new kind of heavy stuff that they're learning. So it really is an interesting dilemma where we need this as a cornerstone of the meat of the course, what we really want to get to, but it requires years in and of itself to develop a good sense of.
Have you taught with the probability unit in the
yes.
same course?
I have, and they still have the same, they still have difficulty, so I don't know that the formal probability unit makes it any better, but then again, it's, you know, 1 week. It's not anything extensive.
Right. However, but when you say formal probability unit, are you talking about mostly the combinatorial approaches to computing probabilities?
And
all the laws of probability.
Yeah.
Very much
the
axiomatic approach.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's the right place to start, and it certainly doesn't even get a lot of time in and of itself.
Right.
But that was kind of what we've done before.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly doesn't get them to, I mean, so to be able to be engaged in inference, we need to be able to have, you know, conversations about, well, what I might expect on theory and what happens in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the article that I had suggested, and there's been several people, I actually have an article under review that I'd be happy to share, another one that's currently under revision. But several people trying to kind of talk about, well, what is the underlying kind of probability that's necessary, and what Canold and Kazak and several others, I had participated in a a symposium with them, and all of us have papers coming out of that. Theirs just happened to be the first one that got published, of all of us trying to talk about the connections between theoretical models and empirical data in probabilistic situations. And so in their paper at the very end, they present their approach that they're taking with middle school students and how they're really trying to get them to have kind of back and forth conversations between theory and data, and really starting of, you know, based on what you know about theory, can you develop a sample space, and from that sample space, can you develop an expectation of what might occur when we collect some data? And then once you get the data, does your data match your expectations, or do you need to change your model? And what I think they don't do, and what's something that that I try to do in my work, is that you also have to be able to get people to a point to think about how, if you just see, and this is where I think inference comes in, if there's something about the context in which it is nearly impossible to come up with an initial hypothesis or a theoretical model of what it is. So it's not something simple like a die toss or something physical that you can examine, but it is, to just use a simple example of, you know, you have a you have a tack, and you want to see, you know, how often is it going to, if I toss this tack, that it will actually land on the flat side, or it will land on with the flat head down. It's pretty hard to look at a tack and think about how you might assign those probabilities. So you almost have to start with a data perspective and examine the data and try to think about how that data might tell you something about the probabilities, about the model. So I think there are several people talking about how it's that type of connection between data and a theoretical probability distribution that may be the key in helping to promote statistical reasoning.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree, and actually I'm just going to jump in because two of the articles that I found are older articles that are really focused on exactly that idea.
Uh-huh.
So one is from 2001, Keeler and Steinhorst, and the other is from 1997 by Carla Ballman. And they're both introducing how they teach probability in their course using that very practical perspective rather than focusing on probability as a theoretical subject.
Uh-huh.
And I think, my personal experience is that really is the way to go.
Okay, I think I posted the one from Keeler and Steinhorst, if that's the one you're talking about.
A new approach to learning probability in the first statistics course?
Yeah.
Perfect. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, sorry, I just happen to be looking at that page right now.
And then I'll just also mention my third one, so I'll be done with mine. My third article is actually someone who had developed an instrument, Hirsch and O'Donnell, for assessing people's understanding about probability, essentially. And I thought their instrument was interesting because most of the questions have a follow-up question about what is their misconception, or how did they come up with that answer? And I'll leave it at that.
What do you mean by misconception question?
Oh, okay. So at the very end of their article, they list their instrument. And for each question, they have a probability question, which are mostly fairly standard probabilities, like, the first roll of a fair die results in a 3. The die is rolled a second time. What is the chance that the second die roll is also a 3? And it gives multiple choice answers for that. But then there's a follow-up that says, which of the following best describes the reason for your answer to the preceding?
Oh, right. Yeah.
And there's
Exactly.
And part of their analysis looks at what proportion of people gave the right answer for the wrong reason.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is something that, again, it's sort of an in-between way of looking at that idea of what are people's reasons for things without doing quite as much of an in-depth qualitative analysis, although I think that might be a good follow-up with a small group of people.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that a lot of the items, if I'm remembering correctly, a lot of the items that Joan and her colleagues through the Artist Project have this type of structure where there's a question and then there's another question about, you know, picking a choice, picking a selection that best describes your reasoning.
Yeah, I think there are several of those, yeah.
Which set of questions are you guys thinking of?
In the, I was actually thinking about the artist database.
The assessment folder.
Oh, it's not the chaos, but the actual artist, okay. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I've pulled some items from that database before to use in different instruments.
Do you have to report your results if you use them? There's a thing you have to sign up and agree to answer emails and stuff.
Right. Because
I was going to use them because we're assessing our statistics courses this semester. We're doing, and we have to come up with common assessment questions for everybody. So I was wanting to look through them to find ones that we could use. But do you, if you use them, do you need to report back to them?
I think they really like it if you do.
Okay.
Right. I haven't reported back to them, but I certainly put in all my publications kind of where those questions came from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've used the Assessment Builder a bunch for different things. And the Assessment Builder, I've never, like, reported anything. But I know that when I use the Chaos Desk, because it's actually online and it's Robert or Bob Delmas, like, keeps the database of all that, because I actually had to email him to get, like, detailed breakdowns of all my results for my dissertation. So they do, I mean, if you use the chaos test, I think they actually keep all that stuff because it's all done online, and so they keep a database. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's fine. I just was curious. All right, so...
So, unfortunately, everyone, this is Holly Lynn. I actually need to get going. I've got to meet with a group of undergrads who are preparing a presentation and who are a bit scared. We're going to a state conference, and their anxiety level is a little high right now. So are we going to, if you are picking a date for November, Thursdays are general. The Thursdays at this time tend to work for me. So,
okay. We'll assume Thanksgiving's out.
Yeah.
Yes, Thanksgiving is out. But anyway, just letting you guys know. Did you all get the email from Joan about trying to come up with a conference call in December? Did she send that out yet?
No.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I think they're trying to plan a conference call with everybody, with all the cluster groups, sometime in December.
Oh, okay.
Can I just say, I think from my perspective that you guys are really doing very well and that you're sort of zeroing in, but you haven't completely settled and you're still discussing, but you've focused your discussion on two topics that, you know, are even somewhat linked to one another. Mm-hmm. I think you're well on track.
That's good. I think we're doing better this month than we were.
Yeah.
We were all over the place before.
At the end of last month, we're all like, we have no idea where we are.
In reading the synthesis documents, it really came through that these topics were coming up again and again, and then you guys identified that in the latest synthesis documents. So I think those are really what's helping, that you're reviewing what you're thinking about and not having each call be totally separate.
Right. Okay, you guys continue on. I will talk to you later. I'm hanging up now. Bye.
All right.
Bye, Holly Lynn.
Bye, Holly.
Jackie, did you want to talk about your article?
Sure. Ironically, the paper I chose is like 4 pages long, but it was actually one that was most useful to me because it was on the language of conditional probability. The main reason why I chose that one is that we've been talking a lot about students really understanding conditional probability to understand inference very well. The main concept about this one was, you know, obviously the confusion of conditional probability, like with the inverse conditional probability, or thinking it was just the probability of the event, or possibly the probability of the intersection. So there's been kind of a, you know, a lot of issues with what identifying what a conditional probability is. And the main thing they talked about is that students probably really don't have an idea what the word given means, and that more of visualizing it, maybe saying like within, to really emphasize that in a sense the sample space has gotten smaller. If they can work with visualizing it that way and then eventually get to the word given so that they can understand p-values a little bit better. The part about p-values, they said, is generally the biggest issue with p-values is they think the complement is the probability that the alternative is true, which I guess I have come across quite a few times myself. But most other papers that I had posted are also about conditional probability. One was about a lot of the different kind of well-known scenarios that involve conditional probability that, you know, might help them understand it a little bit better. That was the main stuff in mine. Other than probably the one thing, and I think I saw this possibly in Hurla's probability one too, that a lot of students unfortunately think of conditional events as having to be sequential.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if A given B, okay, B's had to have happened already and happened first, and so it has to have been something that could have happened first.
Yeah. I think that comment that students don't really understand what the word given means is really interesting. Did they, like, conjecture at what students think of when they think of given, or what?
Really, they just kind of always seem to think that they really just have, you know, no clue, and we give it a symbol, and that's what we say. Because there's a little intro that kind of says, words mean what I want them to mean when I want them to mean that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what we think the word given means, is that to us it obviously means something obviously true, but to a student they really have no idea what that actually means, but it doesn't imply like a subset to them at all. But there was like no actual data done or any like data collection done for this, and it just definitely more conceptual type questions that they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, when I do this, I mean, they kind of latch on to, I mean, the word given. Like, that's just how they end up recognizing that it's supposed to be a conditional probability.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if they see language where it's like, well, what's the probability that a female, you know, has, I don't know, red hair, what, you know, whatever the example is, and there's no given in the sentence, they have no idea what to do with that.
Yeah. I think that's one of those cases where Jackie's talking about they tend to think of it as the intersection then,
mm-hmm.
about,
yeah.
okay, well, she's a female and she has red hair, as opposed to given that you're a female, what's the probability you have red hair?
Well, and that's confused, like, and that's in my calc-based class, because actually we don't teach a probability unit in the intro, like, non-calc-based class, but we do it in the calc-based one, and they almost always think it's the intersection. Almost always.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, one of the other papers that I looked at was, and the one I think that Felicity posted, talked a lot kind of about, in a sense, doing Bayes' rule without it being Bayes' rule and having them, like, do frequency charts to understand it a lot better.
Exactly.
To kind of, you know, see that your subset is actually small. It's like, oh, we know that they're a male now, so we're only working with this group of people now.
No.
Okay. No other discussion on that one?
I'm sorry, it was so unexciting.
No, I actually think it is interesting, and I think with this whole given thing, you could almost do a study kind of like what Jennifer Kaplan and the research cluster group from last time did, where you're looking at the language and what students think of, you know, and it would be kind of interesting to put together either just starting with interview questions about, like, if I give you this word, what does that mean to you? And then putting together a series of conditional probabilities worded differently and seeing can they pick them up? Can they see the parallel structure in them? I think that could be an interesting research study in and of itself.
Yeah, because how do you teach conditional probability if they can't recognize it?
Yeah, if they're struggling with the very, like, language, they just don't understand what you mean when you say that, that would seem to be a pretty big problem.
Well, I'm always surprised at how few students understand things like at least or at most.
Yes.
Or just
yeah.
What the difference between or and, you know, just what or means. If I say that, you know, I want a cat or a dog, you know, or I want that, it is a little frustrating because, I don't know, it just seems, I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of expertise in explaining, you know, what or means. It just,
yeah.
You know, I do my best with it. But yeah, I think but just the language of probability is but yeah, I think you're right, Hurley. There's a whole, you know, I think there's a whole little sub-study right there.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes I think with whenever you teach probability, you know, a lot of us use Venn diagrams to teach it so they can at least visualize what's going on. Conditional probability is one of the hardest ones to draw. I mean, how do you visually show someone conditionally probability? And so now I always try to draw, I'm like, here's our sample space. But, okay, now pretend, look, all this is gone. Now here's our new sample space, trying to emphasize it. But do they get that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Randy. I just have to jump in and say I've got to got to leave now too, but I'll check on the website to see what you decide on for the next call.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Randy.
So has everybody had a chance to talk about their articles? Is that everybody?
Carla, did you want to talk about the other one you talked about? Two of yours, but the one that you actually had said you wanted to talk about was the Watson one. Did you want to talk about that one?
That was the sampling one. And you know what? I can actually keep it right. It was a qualitative study where they looked at kids at different age levels and they asked them interview questions about a sample. And they started with, you know, what does the, if I say sample to you, what does that mean? What do you have if you have a sample? And what was interesting to that was universally the answer was like, a free sample at the grocery store or like a blood sample at the test. Like that, regardless of age, that's pretty much what every single kid said. That's what a sample is. And that actually goes back to this almost like deterministic versus stochastic. Like they, one of the points the article made was how if students think of a sample as a small bit of something that's completely homogenous, like a small piece of cake or a piece of a hot dog that they cut up and give to you at the grocery store, it's really hard to think about a sample in a statistical sense where we're actually looking at variability in a population. So I thought that was kind of an interesting note. And then the interview kind of progressed and it asked about different sampling situations and kind of what size sample you would need. And they were trying to get kids to think about primarily sample size and bias in sample. What method did you use to collect your data and could that lead to bias? And they identified six groups of people, and I put together a summary of their categories and kind of what the defining characteristics of each category was. That's on the Excel table. So I won't just rehash all of that, but the one thing that I thought was really interesting is if you also look on the table, it lists the number of students in each grade level that fell into each of the categories they identified. And there's definitely a progression through the grade levels. Like the categories get progressively more complex and it's the older students who are able to take it that far. So really the reason I picked this article is I thought it could be interesting to repeat either their exact questions or, you know, something similar in college and see, you know, well, we're dealing with students that are even older than this. The highest grade they had was grade 9. And what do our students think? You know, if we were to ask our students what's a sample, would they tell us it's some free food you get at the grocery store, or would they maybe start somewhere more sophisticated, you know? So that's why I flagged this article as the one I wanted to talk about, is it could be interesting to think about what do our college students think about sampling, and can they recognize that large samples are better? And can they recognize that the method that you need, the way you collect the data has an impact on, you know, the potential for bias in the data?
That's an interesting idea. Maybe we should all read this one for next
that
month?
That was what I was just thinking, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Categories.
I think it's a little bit on the long side, but so I kind of skimmed it and I went through. It's got a lot of interviews, so it has snippets that illustrate what the students said. And what's nice is they actually did some written questionnaires and they did some interviews. So in some cases, they were able to look for consistency in the student's logic or recognize when there was inconsistency in the student's logic between what's essentially the same question on a written survey versus when they could probe them in an interview on their responses. So I thought the methodology was interesting from that point of view. So they give you quotes to illustrate. I tried to condense a lot of the good summary information they had. I took like four different tables and put them into one. that's the Excel table that I posted online,
yeah,
so it kind of gets it all in one spot. I know it's massive and there's a lot going on with it, and I don't think it would print on one piece of paper, but it was kind of an overall summary of their conclusions.
That was just interesting because I've read other stuff by Watson, and she does like to do tiers.
Yes.
I've seen tiers before.
They are probably, yeah, I think I've seen that before too, so I'm sure those are her tiers from something from previous work. But, you know, looking at her schema, like what the defining characteristics of the six categories are and how you can see the complexity in their understanding grow through most of the categories, it really does fit interestingly in with the tiers. And even they had this one wild card category almost. It was the only one that didn't fit into the overall hierarchy of just increasing complexity. This was the equivocal samplers, the last category on the table. These were the students that had some type of contradiction. They were confused. They would recognize the need for a large sample, but then they would suggest some type of biased method, or they would recognize the need for a random method, but then they would think that, you know, a small sample would be just as good as a large one. So they were kind of conflicted. And even that category, which didn't fit in kind of her continuum with the other five, still fit within the tier system nicely. So I thought it was a really interesting classification.
Did they really explain like what kind of instruction they'd had before they did all these interviews, or did they
that is probably
detail?
Part of the background I skimmed.
I was just curious. You know, if this was just sort of a general knowledge of what we know about samples, or, you know, does this progress? I mean, obviously, as you go through the grades, you know, you have some exposure to this, hopefully,
yeah,
K through 12, but I'd be interested if they did any kind of either background check to see how much statistics they'd had or how much exposure they'd had to this through the grade levels, or if there was any directed instruction
prior to
interviewing.
One thing I do know is that the interviews that they did for this sample, they pulled the participants out of a larger pool, a larger database that they had from a previous study.
3,000, I had that article.
Yeah, and there, the way they picked these students was they picked them who picked a range of answers, like across the continuum of understanding, and then they also picked the students who gave interesting or unusual responses. So the ones in this sample were kind of more targeted out of a larger sample, but I still don't know what level of instruction the larger sample had.
The larger sample also had more grades. It was 3 to 11.
Was it?
It went up through 11th grade, and it was a longitudinal survey. So it wasn't, I mean, it was the same group of students who took it and then took it again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
At least that's my, I kind of skimmed it. I didn't read the whole article. But that was what I got out of skimming the other article. The one that I had printed out was published actually the same year, 2000. It was in the Journal of Mathematical Behavior.
Yeah, this one was Journal for Research in Mathematics Education.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I liked this study because I thought it did have a lot of rich detail in it in terms of how students think about samples and how their understanding of samples grows. And to me, definitely one of the more interesting parts was how you really could see their complexity grow with age. And this was, I believe, a cross-section. So this wasn't the same students. It was just different students of different ages. And I would be curious to see what happened to that trajectory in college. Would, you know, for students that are learning about statistics for the first time, where is their understanding going to fall? Are they going to more parallel the understanding of the grade 3 students or the understanding of the grade 9 students? Like, is it going to pick up from grade 9 and go up from there? Or is it going to kind of recycle back depending on background knowledge or something, you know, previous experience, whether they took AP or not or that type of thing? Like, I thought that would be really interesting at the collegiate level to see. So that's why I liked this one.
Could we maybe read the two articles? The one that talks about the larger 3,000 people, and then the one that you have that talks about the smaller group that they pulled out for next time?
That's a nice idea.
Yeah, I think that sounds fine.
Yeah.
The one that I have isn't that long. Mine's, it's pages 109 to 136. How long was the one that you said you had?
Pages 44 to 70.
So.
But it's got a lot of, you know, it has the quotes in it and things like that, too. So,
right.
This
one's pretty dense. It doesn't have a lot of.
Okay.
Do you have, so the citation, I don't think I put the page numbers up online, but the citation is there.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one, Developing Concepts of Sampling by Watson and Moritz. Do you have the citation? Was that one of the ones you posted?
I didn't post it. I saw that you had done Watson articles, so I decided not to post mine. I actually have it. I can send an email out with the citation, or I can just scan in. I printed it out. I could just scan it in also and just email it.
Okay. I think that sounds good. And I could probably find a PDF of mine, too. I just went through my university's library.
That's what I did. I could
save it and send it to people.
I'll just
post them on the group site, too.
That's true. It's 4:15. You said you had somebody coming at 4:30 and you wanted some downtime. So should
yes.
we pick our date for next month?
Yeah, I was going to suggest, since Holly Lynn said Thursdays, maybe the 19th, if that's not too late in November for people. It's a week before Thanksgiving. That's 4 weeks from today.
That gives us time to read.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
That works for me.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
This same time again, 3 o'clock?
Yeah, I can't do it. The earliest I can do is 2:30. So.
Okay. All right, we'll read the two articles and... Okay.
All right, sounds good.
Will the 19th, the articles be in the synthesis or something?
My article is in the synthesis, and I will go ahead and just post the full PDF on the files on Google Groups.
Great. I'm just thinking that we need some way to make sure that Holly Lynn and Randy know what to read for next time.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we always include them at the end of the minutes, and we put them in the synthesis, too. I think that's what we've been doing, right?
Yes.
We've been listing the dates and what we have to read.
I got to get caught up. That's all.
Although, you know, if you have a recorder like me who doesn't post the minutes for a month, that doesn't really help. anyway.
Oh, yeah, what are we doing next month?
We all moved down one, right?
So, Hurley, you're organizer.
I can do that.
Let's see.
I will be moderator. Lee will be moderator.
Yep, I am going down the synthesizer, and Jackie, you are going back to note taker.
Yay. I have a question on the recorder position, because I sort of now notice how all of you have been much more detailed than I have. Are most of you guys actually listening to the entire thing and typing out word for word what's said?
Well, only because I'm really bad at taking notes at the time. I didn't do it, like, word for word, but, you know, I kind of would listen to a part and then kind of type up, you know.
The gist kind of
the
idea.
Gist sort of thing. And I mean, I did leave parts out where, you know, we might have been discussing the Snoopies in my office or something along those lines. I figured that wasn't really relevant to, you know, the discussion.
So I just want to make sure when I do it next time that I'm keeping up to speed with what everyone else would like to see.
Yeah. That's my plan for this time, is to go through and listen to the recording, because I have a hard time writing detailed notes and listening at the same time.
Yeah.
So my plan is to go through with the recording and kind of summarize, you know, hit the big ideas. So it won't be word for word. Like Lee said, it'll kind of be little synopses, but it'll be more detailed and more kind of point by point what people said.
Let us know. The first time I did it was our very first, you know, conversation, so there wasn't a lot of detail yet. So
yeah.
Well, and I'll just warn you, it did. The reason it took a month, it takes a while when you do it that way, because, you know, it is. It's time consuming. So, you know, try not to let it get too overwhelming.
Yeah.
I think I kind of let it get the better of me a couple of times. So.
Well, I saw your Facebook post. So.
Yeah. No. Having a long week anyway. So. Anyway.
So then, Lee, how do I get this recording for this?
Well, I'm going to turn it off here in just a second, and then I'm supposed to email Jean and let her know that it's up there, and then she'll probably send it to you. I'll let her know that you're the recorder, so she'll send you a copy of it.
Okay.
Just in email. It's like an MPEG recording. And when you click on it, it just takes you to a website where the recording's on it. So.
All right. Sounds good.
You should get it within 24 hours. That I can actually get done in 24 hours.
Well, that's good. Well, I will try. I have an exam coming up next week that I still have to write and then grade, so I may not get to it very early next week, but I will try my hardest to get to it the week after so that it's posted. So.
Hey, I got to run, but this is really great to finally be involved, and I will talk to you guys in a month.
All right. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Bye. Felicity.
Thank you. Please stand by.